This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk to a perennial guest, one of my favorite guests, who is America's leading integrative cardiologist. He's Dr. Steven Sinatra. He's known to many of you. Many of you probably follow him on his website. If you don't, well, you should, because he puts out a lot of great information. And in fact, we often publish his articles at drhoffman.com. He's kindly consented to share with us some of his content. And his website, and he's got actually several. What is your website again? Oh, yes, heartmdinstitute.com. There's a wealth of information there. And we'll get into the subject of integrative cardiology. Dr. Sinatra has been around for a long time. We've been colleagues as long as I can remember in this field. He was an up-and-coming young physician like I was in the 1980s, and so he became founder in 1987 of the New England Heart Center, which became renowned as a place, the go-to place for integrative cardiology. He is the originator of the term metabolic cardiology. We're going to get into that in just a few moments. And he has so many accolades, so many great books that he's written that we'd exhaust the whole interview enumerating them. So let's get right into it. Steven, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Hey, Ron, it's great to be here. And do you remember, I think we met for the first time about 20 years ago at an American College of Nutrition meeting.
Boy, you have a great memory. You have a great memory.
Yeah. Yeah, that's when Sherry was alive then and everything. And it was about 20 years ago, because I've been a fellow in that organization since, I think, 2000. So, it was a few years before that.
Right. We're referring to the late, great Sherry Lieberman, who's also been one of our guests on this series. And at the time, I think he gave a talk also at, A4M, and you were also a speaker at A4M, and you had the impression that I was a board-certified endocrinologist, but I was talking about hormones at the time.
Right,
and
right.
So you kept thinking that I was an endocrinologist, but, I'm an integrative physician. I happen to have a lot of dissenting views on endocrinology. They might drum me out of the field of endocrinology, just like you might have trouble with some of your fellow cardiologists espousing renegade views. But what's interesting is that the views that you've espoused have actually come front and center to some extent, even in mainstream cardiology, your dietary views, your views on nutritional support. So maybe we could start with talking a little bit about what the meaning of metabolic cardiology is and how this has really grown in significance since you first coined the term.
Yeah, actually it has. It's amazing, Ron, but metabolic cardiology is a term I coined because basically it means driving enzymatic reactions in the body in a preferential direction that helps heal the heart or helps support the heart. And everybody remembers high school biology. We remember mitochondria, remember studying cells and nuclei and stuff like that. But there was one substance. It's really the chi of our body. It's the energy of our body. We call it ATP or adenosine triphosphate, which is a chemical term. And basically, without that, I couldn't be talking to you now. And our body makes it, a million times per second. But we only had 8 seconds of it. And even during World War II, when the German war criminals were privy to this information, they knew that suicide could be created by shutting down the Krebs cycle. And when you do that, you turn off the production of ATP, and it happens within seconds, 8 seconds. So they only have 8 seconds of ATP.
So the application is they dished it out to their secret agents so that if they were discovered, they could swallow the proverbial poison pill that you see in all those B movies.
Yeah, the cyanide.
Oh, okay, right.
I mean, cyanide, bingo. Yeah, cyanide works quick because
it attacks the respiratory chain. Yeah, I didn't realize that.
It
yes.
attacks the Krebs cycle, yep. and it just shuts it down. So it's amazing that, you know, when we look back on that, you know, sometimes good comes out of evil. And when you look at that, we realize the Krebs cycle or really ATP is really the essence of life. So metabolic cardiology is just taking biochemical situations, taking CoQ10, taking carnitine, taking magnesium and D-ribose, which is the center of the ATP ring, the molecule, and giving those, you know, supplements to people, and it drives these enzymatic reactions. We drive and we help to turn over ATP, we make ATP, and that's our chi energy, that's our energy of life. So I used it for years in starvation of heart, so to speak. You know, heart failure is a heart that's literally starving for energy, you know, and people don't realize it, but sometimes simple nutraceutical supports can make all the difference in our health and aliveness.
You know, and we're making some progress, I think, in stemming the tide of heart attacks. I mean, statistically, heart attacks are down, although I wish I had a buck for everybody who has a heart attack who's even on, you know, all these statin drugs. It's not a perfect bulwark against all misfortune. But what we're seeing is that as more people survive heart attacks through these marvelous techniques, you know, they put an immediate stent in you or they bypass you instantaneously within minutes of your chest pain, we're seeing a lot more people develop congestive heart failure. And that is really kind of the bête noire of cardiology, is that unfortunately, we really don't have good drugs for congestive heart failure, right?
No, I mean, things have changed very little in the last, you know, 40 years. I mean, the conventional approach to heart failure, I mean, it treats a lot of symptoms. I mean, it's really good for people who can't breathe, or shortness of breath. I mean, there's ACE inhibitors we use, there's diuretics. We can use what we call inotropic agents for the heart that help enhance contractility. But all what these drugs do is they make people feel more comfortable with heart failure or cardiac dysfunction. What metabolic cardiology does, I believe, is that not only does it make people feel better, you know, with their symptoms, but I think it helps to reverse the problem. And Ron, I don't know if we ever discussed this, but I always wondered why metabolic cardiology would work. Remember when we were in medical school and they always said like the 5-year survival of cancer was about what was fair to good, but the 5-year survival of heart failure was terrible. In other words, people with cancer were living longer than people with heart failure. And you know, that statistic stuck with me. Yeah.
It's a dead end diagnosis. It really is.
It is. It really is. And then when I started using CoQ10 back in the early 80s, and then I added carnitine to the mix, you know, several years later. And then I was always using magnesium. My gosh, I was always, even in my training, I was using magnesium. But then when I added D-ribose to the picture back in 2004, it was amazing. So anyway, I was one day reading a journal article. It was out of the Scandinavian literature. It was right out of the journal Science. Are you familiar with the journal Science?
Oh, indeed, yeah.
It's a good journal. And in this article in 2009, I had this chill go through my body. It was unbelievable. I'm reading this article, and what the article is saying is that we all have intrinsic stem cells in our body. In other words, we all have the capability of healing any illness in our body because there are primitive stem cells, and they usually last up until we're about 80 years old. And after that, the primitive stem cells tend to die out. They get less and less. And I'm reading this article, and all of a sudden, I had this chill in my body, because when I was using metabolic cardiology, people were living 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years. I'm saying to myself, these are people with massive heart attacks, with low ejection fractions. I had so many people on heart transplant lists that came off.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, your listeners can go to Amazon.com and it can, you know, put in a metabolic cardiology book and read all these testimonials by people that my husband was on a heart transplant list, not anymore, et cetera, et cetera. And this is happening now. It happened 10 years ago. And, you know, when the book first came out, But I got to tell you, when I read the article in Science, this chill came through my body. And I had this incredible aha. And what that was I was thinking to myself, were these people living longer because my metabolic approach invigorated ATP? And is ATP the stepping stone to sort of supporting stem cell activity? Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about this, and I'm saying, oh my gosh, it makes sense. And then when this article came out in 2009, it verified it. In other words, if you can stimulate your own stem cell activity, and you've had a massive heart attack, you can regenerate your heart. Now, I'm taking this out of the article. Up to 40% of the time, if you live a few decades. In other words, if you have a dead heart, and we've seen lots of, quote, dead hearts, ejection mm-hmm. fractions of less than 10%, you know, massive heart attacks that have survived, and now all of a sudden you resurrect these people, well, now if they live 5, 10, 15 years, now their own intrinsic stem cells are taking over, and they're developing new tissue in their hearts. Mm. I mean, think about that. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, the way I looked at this metabolic cardiology concept is that, you know, what's dead is dead, and you just power up the remaining tissue. But when you see spectacular results of people who have, you know, terrible ejection fractions, you wonder, is it just the residual heart tissue that's being revived, or are they actually regenerating heart tissue? You know, we talk about neuroplasticity of the brain, the ability to recover brain cells, and maybe there's right. cardioplasticity. There's actually the ability to affect repair and regeneration if you just put the right ingredients in.
Correct. And by the way, all this started after the nuclear atomic war testing in Nevada and New Mexico, you know, in the late 40s, early 50s. Because now, through carbon-14 testing, we can determine the age of all our cells. And that's how this all came out. So, I mean, this is amazing, I have to tell you. So, even some of the congenital cases I've had, I'll tell you, Ron, I'll never forget it. I had a 9-year-old boy in my office. Now he's 31, right? This is years ago in my practice. Mm-hmm. And the parents are crying. They're sobbing in my office because this 9-year-old boy, they couldn't find a heart transplant for him, and he was dying. Yeah. And they brought him to me because they heard about, and I don't do pediatric cardiology. I mean, I take care of pediatric kids, but, you know, rarely. I mean, maybe once.
You made an exception. You said, you know,
yeah.
It's like compassionate kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, and do the right thing, right? So I put the child on CoQ10 and carnitine back then and magnesium. I didn't even know about ribose back then. And he started to thrive. And then in 2004, I added ribose. Now this boy he's 31. He's not a boy. He's a man now. He's 31 years old. He's the oldest living doublet, we call it a doublet outlet single ventricle in the world. Yeah. And, you know, he's seen at, you know, other institutions in New England. And, you know, a lot of the doctors are baffled, you know, why he's still alive. And it's amazing. But, like, you know, he's a testimony to metabolic cardiology. Mm-hmm. And I've had so many patients who I took off heart transplant lists. And I really believe, again, that the heart has the intrinsic wisdom to regenerate itself mm-hmm. if you give it the right stuff, you know, with the right fertilizers, the right foods, the right nutraceuticals, the right ingredients. So, you know, it's a stretch, but for me, I mean, I've just seen so many, quote, miracles in my career that I really believe it.
Well, with so many choices out there for the consumers, obviously there's some confusion. There's claims that ubiquinol is better, CoQ10, it will suffice. I think you're on the CoQ10 side of the equation. But how much does it take? Do you really need to take massive amounts? I mean, what I've noticed is that, you know, if you take an ordinary amount of CoQ10, you know, 30 or 50, I don't know, maybe that might offer some preventive benefits, but it's not going to turn the corner for someone with a really bad heart problem.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the ubiquinol situation, that's going to be coming to an end soon because the patents are ending on ubiquinol with Canica. But I'll tell you this.
How do you mean
a high quality ubiquinol?
How do you mean? In other words, when it's when all manufacturers can make it, it's going to lose its
exclusivity? Yeah, it's not going to be special anymore. Okay. Yeah, it's, you know, a lot of this is marketing. I mean, listen, if you have a high quality ubiquinol, which is an oxidized form of mm-hmm. pure CoQ10, mm-hmm. that's going to work as well as ubiquinol. There's no question. You know, ubiquinol is more expensive, But if you get a Q10, you know, ubiquinone that works, I mean that's what I've been using for years. I mean, I was one of the original researchers on a high quality ubiquinone, and it's all about blood levels, Ron. You know, Some people may get 30 or 50 milligrams of CoQ10 for preventive purposes, but when you have people with, you know, high grade cardiovascular illness, who are very symptomatic, you need to get blood levels up to maybe 3 to 6 times above the normal level. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did in my practice.
So what would that be, like a 3 or a 6? I mean, for our listening audience, they don't know what that means, but we do test our patients.
Yeah, the normal blood level is about 0.8. Mm-hmm. So if you get anything above 2.5, mm-hmm. to let's say 3.5, preferably above 3.5 for really severe heart failure, mm-hmm. These people thrive. So it's all about blood levels.
So this is interesting because for those of you who are out there who's kind of flying blind, you know, you're taking whatever, you know, as much as you can afford to take, you may want to check in and have a doctor, you know, particularly someone who's attuned to this metabolic cardiology, like Dr. Sinatra, or myself, check a level to see if indeed you're achieving the level that you need. Now, this is not for everyone, right? This is not, you know, your ordinary person who's like, I don't know, maybe 50 years old and maybe they got a little family history, but everything's fine. Their cholesterol is fine. They're not on a statin drug. And, you know, they're pretty fit. They don't smoke. They're normal weight. They don't need to take these massive doses, 300, 400, 500 milligrams of CoQ10 every day.
No. In fact, getting blood levels is not for everyone either. I drew blood levels initially to try to figure out the ideal blood level, and I realized it was between 2.5 UGs and 3.5 was really, or above that, was really the ideal blood level. But you see, when I had failures in my practice on CoQ10, before I threw CoQ10 under the bus, so to speak, I would draw a blood level. Because early in my career, I realized there were a lot of CoQ10s out there that did not achieve a good blood level. This is when everything was ubiquinone. Mm-hmm. In other words, the ubiquinol wasn't even out then.
Yeah.
And basically, there were, you know, better absorbed CoQ10s. I mean, CoQ10s that are in an oil base are better absorbed than a powder base, for example. Right. You know, and when you have a good absorbable form of CoQ10 and it gets into the bloodstream, that's what you really need. Mm-hmm. So, you know, any form of CoQ10 that gets absorbed, in my mind, you know, works well.
Right. So how about this one? A lot of people are on statins, and statins are said to somewhat offset the blocking effect of statin drugs on something called HMG-CoA reductase, which is the you know, pathway to cholesterol, but also happens to be the pathway to CoQ10. So, you know, you're killing your CoQ10 when you take these things. You need to take CoQ10 with a statin. Everyone, this should be mandatory. But what's the amount that's generally suggested? Or, again, is it variable based on, say, how many, how, you know, whether somebody's taking 80 of Lipitor or 5 of Crestor, you know, how do you calibrate that?
Yeah, I mean, on anybody on a statin drug, my minimum dose of CoQ10, whether it was ubiquinol or a high-quality ubiquinone, was 100 milligrams, a minimum of 100 milligrams. Okay. And frequently, I would go up to 200 milligrams, you know, depending if the person had joint discomfort, muscle pain, things like that, you know. I would treat
that.
A lot of symptoms.
Thanks for that, because that's precisely what I'm doing, so I feel reassured that
that's good. You got validated.
Yeah, I got validated.
It's always good to have another doc validate
exactly,
you, isn't it?
Exactly.
Because, I mean, we've been around the block to know that if you go to 5 different doctors, you're going to get 5 different opinions.
Exactly. So, with the muscle pain thing, what I've noticed is that I think CoQ10 may help, but there's just some people that you could give them a boxcar load of CoQ10 for some genetic reason, perhaps. They still have that pain, and CoQ10 can't abolish it. Can you think of anything, any other supplement or any procedure that's going to help people?
Yeah, actually, some of these people, you hit a very, very important point, because sometimes you can give these people a load of CoQ10 and they still have muscle pain.
Yeah.
Some of these people, it's amazing, but some of these people have inborn errors of metabolism where they need carnitine.
Okay.
Where, like McArdle syndrome and some of these crazy little syndromes out there that they've been dealt a bad set of genetics. So that's when you got to use the full metabolic approach,
like,
you know, carnitine, magnesium, and even ribose
or something like that is screwy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. In other words, just just, you know, load them up, because I'll tell you, there's more inborn errors of metabolism. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, the Biogenome Project, I think, is going to be the most important thing going forward, where, you know, remember the old days in medicine, we'd be on the wards, and somebody would come in with some symptoms, we'd run through a differential diagnosis, we would get these lab tests, try these medications, et cetera, et cetera. I think the doctor of the future is, all they're going to do is do genetic testing and mm-hmm. find out where mm-hmm. all our blocks are, where our weaknesses yep. are, and just fortify the defenses, and voila. I mean, I think stem cell technologies and the Biogenome Project is really where it's at for the future of medicine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's not yet ready for prime time, but very promising. So when we're talking about some of these other nutrients, do you pile it on with carnitine, magnesium, and or ribose? I'm thinking your recommendation for ribose is about 5 milligrams three times daily for starters. That's about a teaspoon three times daily. It's a powder.
Yeah, it's 5 grams. It's grams. Right. Yeah, it's grams of ribose. Yeah, it's a full teaspoon three times a day for people with moderate to severe heart failure. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for people with angina or maybe, you know, arrhythmias or hypertension mm-hmm. or, you know, lesser degrees of heart disease, a teaspoon twice a day is
for maintenance.
Efficient. For maintenance. Because I'll tell you, one of the things I've learned from, you know, treating loads of cardiac patients is that sick cardiac patients deplete their ATP stores. Mm-hmm. And it takes the heart, or it takes the body, the normal physiology of the body, sometimes days, weeks, to build it back up naturally. So a lot of these cardiac patients need to take ribose on a daily basis, because it's the building block of ATP. And again, if the body can't make it back fast enough, these people are exhausted, sluggish, they get short of breath at night, they can't walk across the room. When they start taking ribose, they start to thrive, because then they develop, you know, more ATP, which, like I said before, it's the energy of life. It's our chi. It's our, mm-hmm. it's the remarkable energy that really drives us.
Do you have a favorite form of magnesium that's more bioavailable or more suitable for heart problems?
Well, the magnesium that I developed for Healthy Directions, and this is self-serving, because, you know, people order it. I get some income from it.
Where can people find it, by the way? Because you talk about supplements and your recommendations, I think people want to.
Oh, it's at drsinatra.com.
Yeah,
that's my supplement.
Okay.
Yeah, Dr. Sinatra. Okay. But I'll tell you, the magnesium one that I use is a combination of glycinate, citrate, malate, and orotate. And I love magnesium orotate. I learned this from the Australians about 15 mm-hmm. years ago.
It was Dr. Atkins' favorite form of magnesium.
He used orotate as well?
Big time. Yeah, he was...
Didn't know that about him.
And it was... You know, the problem with pure orotate is that it's very expensive, and also...
Oh, it's frightfully expensive,
and
yeah.
Also, you really should combine it with other forms of magnesium, because you'd have to take a whole handful of pills to get your requisite magnesium. So it's prudent to use maybe a little bit in combination with other things like you've formulated.
Yeah, that's my formula. That's mm-hmm. my broad spectrum magnesium.
Right.
And I got to tell you, Ron, I take that every single night. Mm-hmm. This is kind of funny, but you know how everybody brushes their teeth at night before bedtime?
Yep.
Well, I keep my magnesium bottle next to my toothbrush after I brush my teeth. My chaser is, you know, 3 capsules of magnesium.
Right.
By the way, it also helps you sleep a little better in this day and age of electromagnetics with a little Wi-Fi and you know, the sea of electromagnetic soup. It drives down melatonin and stuff like that. So magnesium as a relaxant, because it does relax not only blood vessels but muscles as well.
It's, no question.
It's a good supplement to take if you can't sleep.
Yeah, we give it to people who are stressed and anxious and have sleep problems. Then when it comes to the carnitine, again, boxcar loads of carnitine, or will, you know, maybe a gram or two suffice?
Oh, yeah. With carnitine, I've learned over the years that less is more. You know, it's amazing, but there's very few foods that contain a lot of carnitine. I mean, lamb is probably the best mm-hmm. one, you know. And
beef
maybe
heart, of course, would. But
yeah,
not a
beef, you know, beef heart would have a lot. Right. Oh, my God, that would have a lot. But who eats beef heart, you know,
exactly.
or chicken heart? But like beef in itself has carnitine, you know, the flesh of beef, but not as much as lamb. Lamb is really probably the one food that contains the most natural carnitine.
Mm-hmm. And but when it comes
it's not found in plant foods, by the way. It's ubiquitous. I mean, it's very small amounts are found, but
you can synthesize it from lysine, I believe. But if your metabolic machinery is impaired, you just don't make enough. When it comes to supplementation, there are different forms of carnitine out there. What ones do you recommend?
I like pure L-carnitine. Mm-hmm. However, if you're dealing with CNS issues, you know, central nervous system mm-hmm. issues, like
you want acetyl-L-carnitine.
Acetyl-L-carnitine crosses the blood-brain barrier. And then in healthy directions, I used to have a broad-spectrum carnitine where I had the propylenol-L-carnitine, mm-hmm. which is great for the heart. So you have propylenol-L, you have L-carnitine, and acetyl-L. I had 333 milligrams each, but, you know, we didn't sell it that much, and it broke my heart. I got to tell you, it broke my heart when the management came back to me and I said, we got to cancel it. And I had patients that love that stuff.
It's terrible being in the creative process saying, this is really the best, and then you're subject to these commercial considerations because it's got to be the right price point and it's got to, you know, whatever. Because everybody wants to take something that costs $19.95 for, you know, a 30-day supply. It doesn't sometimes work out that way. All right, we need to pause for a moment because we divide this podcast into two parts. And when we return, we're going to focus on one of Dr. Stephen Sinatra's themes, which is the cholesterol myth. Is it really a myth? We'll consider that in just a moment. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.